This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Is the supermassive black hole Sagittarius A star orbiting the galactic centre of mass, or does it sit spot on at that centre?
Well, everything in the galaxy orbits the galactic centre of mass, whether it's a single atom or a supermassive black hole. This centre of the mass is called the barycentre, but it's rather less defined than you might think. Let's take a more familiar example. The solar system is fairly easy. We've got a sizable star sitting in the middle, and a few fairly piddly planets orbiting it. The solar system barycentre can be fixed within a few kilometres by only taking into account the few most massive objects, so we can accurately plot how the Sun does its merry little dance around it. But for our galaxy, there's a major difference. The black hole in the centre makes up only a tiny fraction of the galaxy. A million solar masses isn't trifling, but you could easily lose a million solar masses elsewhere in the galaxy, and no one would bat an eyelid. Gas bubbles are being ejected out of the galaxy every time a supernova goes off, and that material is constantly raining back down into the galactic plane. Entire dwarf galaxies are being cannibalized by the Milky Way as we speak, and their spaghettified remains continue to orbit the galaxy in faint streams. And as for dark matter, well, we've only got the most general idea of how that's distributed. So it's easy enough to work out where the supermassive black hole is, and where it's moving. It's surprisingly hard to work out with that kind of accuracy where the middle of the galaxy is. We know it's somewhere very close to Sagittarius A star, perhaps within it. But for convenience, we just define the supermassive black hole as being directly at the galaxy centre.
Next question is, how much less would my weight have been if I had weighed myself during the eclipse? And that comes from Michelle Dempsey.
Now, Michelle hints an important point here. The Sun and the Moon affect our tides, but they don't just pull in the oceans, they pull in the rest of the world too, including us. Now, thankfully, the gravitational pull of the Earth is always much greater, so neither do we fly off into space every time the Moon comes overhead, nor does the Earth disintegrate into a pile of molten goo. But just how much stronger is the Earth's gravity? Well, for this argument, I'm going to ignore the fact that the Earth is continuously accelerating in its orbit around the Earth-Moon barycentre, and just look at the pull of the Moon on you. Let's say that you were standing in Manchester during the last eclipse. The pull of the Moon's gravity would have been a little under 4 millionths of that of the Earth, but it's also directed mostly sideways instead of straight up, because the Moon was close to the horizon. If we say that you have the average European body mass of about 70 kilos, then it would have resulted in those scales dropping by about 129 milligrams. Now that's not very much. The hair on your head gets heavier by about this much every day. So if you want to have a quick diet, this may not be the one for you. So let's look at what else you can do to lose some weight. Well, the first thing you can do is change your latitude. The centrifugal force provided by the Earth's rotation gives some counterbalance against the pull of gravity. So the closer to the equator you are, the less you weigh. If you were standing in Singapore, for instance, you would weigh about 300 grams, or 10.5 ounces, less than you will in Manchester. The other thing that you can do is change your height. The further from the Earth's centre you go, the less the pull of gravity, and the greater that centrifugal force. What we ideally want is a tall mountain near the equator. And in fact, the furthest point from the Earth's centre is Mount Chimborazo in the Ecuadorian Andes. An exact figure for how much less you'd weigh there is difficult to determine, because you have to take into account the gravity of the Andes themselves. But it probably should be about 100 to 140 grams, or 4 to 6 ounces. Though to be fair, you'd probably burn off more than that in fat just by climbing it, and you'd probably put on more weight and blood volume through the altitude acclimatization you'd have to do. So it's possible to change your weight by about a pound, just by moving around the Earth's surface. And climbing in the Andes is likely to be better for your health than lunar-based dieting. And if you want to stay put during the next eclipse, you'd probably be better losing weight by getting a shorter haircut.
Handy astronomical tips there. So the final question is, why don't we have 13 months instead of 12? Wouldn't it make more sense having 28 days in each month? And that's from John Brooks.
It's not a new idea of having 13 months of 28 days, making 364 days in total. It's been around since about 1745, or even earlier, but it's never really caught on. The primary argument has been, well, we've always done it this way, and it would be too difficult to change to something else. The only really incontestable argument is that it then becomes rather difficult to do things on a quarterly basis. The interrelation of months and years is a long and complicated history, and it varies little from culture to culture. But in almost every calendar system older than the 1800s, there's a close relationship between the lunar cycle and the year. In fact, in virtually every European language, the words for month and moon come from the same root. thought to be the Indo-European word mens. And archaeological research suggests the moon has been used for a timekeeping tool for at least 30,000 years. However, the rather inconvenient fact remains that the lunar month is 29.53059 days long, and this doesn't really fit conveniently into the 365¼ day year. There's 12.3685 of them. And that's the first part to your answer. They're closer to 12 lunations every year rather than 13. Now, different calendar systems have come up with different solutions to the problem of the difference between the lunar and solar calendars. Some calendars solved the problem by stuffing in a 13th or intercalary month on occasion. This included the ancient Roman calendar of Numa, which has been in use since about 713 BC. And our modern calendar directly descends from this. Julius Caesar replaced the old Roman calendar with the Julian calendar, and its successor, the Gregorian calendar, is the one that we use today. Now, this solved the problem by doing away with the occasional 13th month entirely, and spreading out the other 12 months to fit the rest. So why spread it out into 12 months, rather than cramming it into 13? Well, 12 months was more normal, as the 13th month was only used in 7 out of every 19 years. However, there's also a deeply rooted mythology in the number 12, probably partly due to its divisibility compared to 13. The Romans considered odd numbers unlucky, but there's a deeper link that stretches back into prehistory. Our 12 and 24-hour clocks have roots in the ancient Near East, and the number 12 was probably chosen here as a link to the number of months in the year.
Great answer. Thanks for that, Ian. So if you want to send in your own questions, you can do so on the website at www.jodcast.net.